Continuing with Grote Reber on 12 March 78.
Once you got to NBS, one of the things that you were interested in doing was building a big dish, and you put quite a bit of effort into designing it.
That's right.
And could you tell me about that?
Well, it was pretty obvious that with the receiving equipment available at that time, everything was sensitivity limited, so we needed a lot of pickup area to get something to listen to. And a big dish seemed to be the answer, so I made an assortment of engineering designs and built a small model and tried to promote it, but I didn't get anywhere because it was only 1948 or 1949, and that was about 10 years before big dishes got any kind of respectability. And the thing that was curious is that while this design, of course, was an enlargement and pretty much a copy of my 30-foot dish in Wheaton, the blokes at Sugar Grove copied my design and expanded up another factor of 300 to 600 feet and then failed.
Yeah. Some things you can't just scale up.
Right? That's right. You got to do more than just scale it up.
Right. But did you have any cost estimates for it at that time? Or cost estimates? I mean, we saw an entire box full of drawings and so forth. Yeah. Did you ever come up with a number as to how much this was going to cost?
Oh, no, we didn't cost it. But it was going to cost, a couple $100,000 anyhow, even in that day. I think how many tons of steel went into it, but yeah. It was designed as cheaply as possible to use simple, well-known and available steel members.
And this actually was considered by AUI in the mid-50s also as a possible
design. Well, yes. AUI finally got started in the early middle 50s when NSF got underway, and they were looking around for a design for a big dish. And I offered my design, and it appeared in one of their resumes of the state of the art, but it wasn't chosen. Mm-hmm. They elected to do something else.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, now we're driving to the airport, and there's a bit of background noise, but anyway. So I'd like to ask you about some of the other interests that you've had besides radio astronomy, electrical engineering, and ionospheric physics, which we've discussed on tape before. And the first one, I think, historically, is the beams business. Is that correct?
Oh, yes.
And could you tell me how you got interested in that and what you did?
Well, I was in Hawaii at the time, and my neighbor planted a row of about 20 poles with climbing beams on them. And I noticed that they all turned the same direction. And I called it to his attention. And much to my surprise, he hadn't noted that, even though he'd been growing these beans for 20 years, perhaps. So I said, oh, look at Jerome. How about me taking all the odd ones, all the odd-numbered poles, and reversing them, the vines, forcibly, and tying them back. He said, sure, we got plenty up here. Some of them died, won't make too much difference. So I did that. And these vines grow fairly rapidly during their few weeks of the growing season. So I had to twine them back and tie them about every 3 days. And these plants grew at the same speed. Apparently, say about a foliage, and they flowered profusely and produced a considerable number of beans. And so we picked the beans and ate them, and they were just as tasty as the ones that grew on normal vines. You couldn't see it was any different whatsoever.
Right.
In other words,
a taste test.
Handling the beans in this fashion, the plants in this fashion, didn't seem to have any effect as far as the growth of the plant, the prolificness of the fruit, or the taste of the fruit. Sure. No effect. Well, that wasn't a very good experiment because it was out of control. There wasn't any control on it. And the main thing that was out of control was the amount of water in the beans. They were all green. So I determined to do the whole thing again much better. And about that time, I went to Greenbank, West Virginia, and worked there for a summer.
What year was that?
About 1959, I think. And I decided to try several varieties. So I had a patch plowed up, and we got a bunch of stakes and put in several rows of different varieties. Each row had about maybe 30 stakes in it. And the odd-numbered ones were allowed to remain normal, and the even-numbered ones were reversed. So we had a similar number of normal and reversed pines. But this time, instead of picking the beans and eating them, I decided we'd try to do it more quantitatively. So I let the beans in the pods mature on the vine, and they dried and withered and got crinkly, and most of the water went out of them. So this reduced one of the variables. And then, well, the beans pods come in different sizes. Some the smallest ones have just one bean in, and there are two bean pods, three, four, five, six, seven, and sometimes even eight or nine beans in a long pod, although they're quite rare. The average pod maybe has about five beans in it. So then they were divided up into groups, that is, how much did 100 big pods weigh that had one bean in from the normal vines and the first vines, and you got the same answer. Two beans in, about the same. By the time we got three beans in, it was apparent that the pods from the first vines weighed less than 100 pods from the normal vines. And this situation accentuated as the number of beans in the pod increased.
It looks like a significantly different difference.
Oh, definitely. Like about 12%. So it was apparent there was something about this thing which was influenced by end effect. If the pod had a lot of ends compared to its center, then you couldn't see it, the phenomena. But if the pod was a long pod and had small ends compared to the center, then the effect was more pronounced.
You're saying an end effect?
Yeah, that is, whatever was changing along the center of the pod, not at the ends.
Oh, I see, yes.
In other words, if the pod had a high ratio of end material to center material, then the phenomenon didn't appear. But if it had a high ratio of center material to end material, like a long pod, then the phenomena was present, and it increased. Okay, so then, pods were shucked, that is, the husk taken off, and the beans taken out. And they were, of course, all carefully sorted. So we had a group of beans from pods with one bean in, another group of two beans, another group of three beans, and so on. And then 100 beans in, say, the three bean group were compared in weight with 100 beans of the normal vines. I couldn't see there was any significant difference. Same with all the other categories. So the change, the difference was not in the beans. They produced about the same number of, same weight of beans. So then I weighed the pods. That's where the difference was. The shucks, pardon me. I weighed the shucks. And that's where the difference was. It turned out that the reversed vines were producing pods that had lighter weight shucks, at least in the upper categories. You couldn't find it in the lower ones, the one and two beans.
Right.
So there was something about the shucks. And I tried to measure the thickness of the shucks with a micrometer, but they're so prickly.
A little squishy, yes.
That's right. You couldn't make anything out of it. And this was done again a couple more times with some other varieties, and they all responded the same way. So, this demonstrated that if you handled the plant in this particular fashion and reacted in that particular fashion, but nobody explained why it did this. Although the handling of plants is nothing new, that is, orchardists manipulate their trees, and people prune tomato plants to make them fruit sooner, and hedges and so on are manipulated. It's a common thing, but as far as I know, nobody else had ever tried to do it on beans.
Did you search the literature at all to see if anyone had worried about the sense of the helicity of
Oh, yes. That's a very popular thing, especially in the lots of articles about that. And the best one, though, was in a book written by a man whose name I can't remember, but he was an Englishman, and he arrived in India in the heyday of the British Imperial India.
Right.
And he nominally taught school in botany, I guess, in Bombay. But he had a lot of time, and he had a lot of assistance, and he used to go out and search the Indian countryside for new and interesting kinds of plants. And he wrote several volumes. One of these was Indian plant, or Planting Vines in India.
I see, a whole book.
A whole book. And he had a lot of them. That is, whole scores. I didn't count them up, but he divided them up into right-handed turning vines and left-handed turning vines. And this book had about 400 pages, and they were approximately equally divided, about half as many pages on half the pages on one side and half the pages for the other way. So in India, the number of vines turning one way are equal to the number of vines turning the other way.
But the same species always turns the same way.
Well, not necessarily. It does with beans. All the different varieties of beans, they always turn the same way. And all the different varieties of hops turn the same way, which is the opposite way.
No, but I mean, if you have a single species, all individual plants always turn the same way.
No.
There are some that go up both ways.
Yes.
What part of the book were they in?
Well, I don't remember. I didn't read the book in detail. I just thought it was ruined, see? But my own observations are that there are some species of twining plants wherein some of the members turn one way and some of the members turn the other way. For instance, there's a bulb in California called Rhodiaea volubilis. It grows on the slopes of the Cascade. Is that right? Anyhow, the slopes of the mountains there. Rather high up, it's a bulb and sends up a single runner. It looks like a runner of climbing beans, but there's no leaves on it. It just has a small flower at the very top.
Uh-huh.
It grows maybe 6 or 8 feet high. And I found this in the Santa Ana Botanical Gardens near Pasadena. And I wandered around there one day. I was staying with a friend in Pasadena. I went over and spent the day at the botanical garden wandering around to see what I could see. And here was the peculiar kind of vines growing up a small wire trellis. And they were obviously coming out of bulbs on the ground. Some of them were turning one way and some of them were turning the other way.
I see.
And they were all Rhodiaea volubilis. So I went into the office and introduced myself and asked for talked to the head botanist, who turned out to be a man named Mr. Everett. And I discussed this with him, and he knew that there were Rhodiaea volubilis out there, but he was not aware that they turned one way or the other way, and they were twining vines. So we discussed this, and I had him get out the card file and find out where they came from, and how long they'd been there, and how fast they grew, and all that kind of stuff. Which he obligingly did. While we were digging through this, a rather large, heavy-set, gray-haired man came in and injected himself into the conversation and came out with an absolutely flat statement that twining vines turned one way in the northern hemisphere and turned the other way in the southern hemisphere.
I see.
And I said, well, sir, I don't think that is true because I've been in Australia, having just come back recently, and I have planted beans down there and they turn the same way down there as they turn here. He says, you didn't do it right. So I said, well, maybe I didn't do it right, but this is what I saw. He said, well, there was something the matter.
I think he may have gotten mixed up with his freshman physics course about tubs draining.
So he then lit into Mr. Everett about this subject matter, and Everett wanted to argue with him about it, and then he turned to me, and he says, it has been proven in the literature that the vines turn one way in the northern hemisphere and turn the other way in the southern hemisphere. It has been proven in the literature. So I figured there's no point to arguing with anybody who has seen it proven in the literature. Anyhow, about this time, the thing got so heated that I decided it was a good time to leave. So The other gentleman there was named Mr. Ball, who was head gardener. So Ball and I left. Ball was obviously just as anxious to get out of there as I was. So Everett was stuck with this gentleman. So after we get out, I said to Ball, say, who is that big old gray-haired fellow with a crotchety disposition? Ball says, oh, that is Dr. Muntz, M-U-N-T-Z. He's the director.
I see.
So, obviously, Dr. Muntz knew what was in the literature, but he didn't know what was going on in the garden. Anyhow.
Did you ever look up these papers that claimed to see?
Well, then I got home late that night to where I was staying with my friend, and he taught school at one of these places in the environment there. And I mentioned this to him. I said, he says, oh, think nothing of it. That is the way Dr. Muntz is. That you accidentally somehow stepped on one of his pet peeves. This is where we turn left.
But you never, did you ever look up these articles? The claim?
Just a minute. Let me get around this corner here. So, this fellow's name was Bill Woods. He says, we got a little time this evening, and it seems to me that Muntz has written a new book recently. So, we went over to the University or College Library, and it was open. And so, Bill fished up this book by Dr. something or other, Muntz, and thumbed through the index, and came out with the interesting statement by Dr. Muntz, just as he had stated it. In the book it said that twining vines turned one way in the northern hemisphere and turned the other way in the southern hemisphere. So Dr. Muntz knew what was in his book.
Right.
And I don't remember whether there was any references or anything like that given. There probably was, but Bill says, forget it, that Dr. Muntz is that way and it's not to be thought anything of. So that was that. Since then I've learned Dr. Muntz has departed.
So you published these results in a small West Virginia journal called Castanea, I believe.
That's right.
And you then continued your researches, and you were just telling me you sent the second paper also to them.
That's right.
And what happened then?
Well, the first paper was sent there because the work was done at Greenbank, West Virginia, and that seemed to be suitable. Boy, I hope I know what I'm doing. I think that's all right. Yeah, it's all right. As it turns right up here, just at the top of this hill. So, they accepted it, apparently with some misgivings. And then I left there, and later work was done here in Tasmania. And so the second collection of evidence and its interpretation were also sent to the editor, and he politely returned it and said that it was not suitable for their publication, and he inferred strongly that he had been reprimanded by his directors for letting this kind of material appear in their journal, which was supposed to be devoted to survey botany, that is, the description and discovery of plants and their habitats and how they reproduced and so on, see. So it struck me as though this was just 100 years later the kind of thing that it happened to Gregor Mendel, because the chairman of the meeting here, wherever it was he gave this speech, was severely reprimanded by his board of directors for allowing this kind of a statistical, mathematical material to appear at the chair of a botanical society.
Right.
Just had no business there.
Well, let's see. Let's move on to another one of your interests. How about the carbon dating that you did of various Aboriginal remains.
Well, that had its origin in Hawaii also. There, there were lava flows that ran through forests, and they left sort of holes where the flow went around a large tree, which ultimately rotted out, but there were charred roots underneath.
Yeah.
So I went around and dug some of these up and sent them away for carbon dating. It might be expected. We only got dates of a few hundred years because all the old flows were down underneath. The dates weren't very good either. They had a very high percent error, but it gave some idea. You can probably tell one flow is earlier than another flow.
Right, continue.
Well, that was all it was to that, and I moved down here. So, I was just idly wandering around the Derwent Estuary, and I took a boat trip down to the South Arm, got off there and wandered up about 3 miles to another place where the boat would come back later in the day and pick me up, take me back to Hobart. And while I was walking along, I noticed that there was a hill where the road department had cut a gash in the side of it, trying to straighten out a bend in the road. And this hill was in fact a sand dune. It had some grass on top, but it was about a foot and a half mixture of shells and charcoal between the top of the sand dune and the grass on the surface. And this obviously was what the archaeologists call a kitchen mitten. That is, the blacks came and fished up their shells and seafood and cooked them. These are usually pretty close to the place where they can harvest them out of the water. Bottom, I picked it out maybe 6 inches from the bottom and sent it for a date. And I thought I'd get a few hundred years maybe, but much to my surprise, I got a date of 2080, about plus or minus 150 or so, which was an improvement. Anyhow, this made it more interesting. So I enlisted the help of another fella who was like mine. And over the next several years, maybe 3 years, we visited a number of these places around the island. They're all around the seashore because the blacks have been here a long time. And the idea was quite simple. I think you can get down that way, but I'm going up here a little farther. Anyhow, the blacks lived there, and we thought we'd just arbitrarily select samples because they looked all more or less alike, and how big these kitchen mittens were didn't necessarily depend on the age, but rather upon how fast the shellfish grew. So we dug to the bottom of maybe 15 or 20 and got an assortment of dates. And in theory, we should get a random collection of numbers out to some number where there might be one or two close together, and then nothing beyond that. So that would be the time when the blacks arrived. That sounds pretty simple and straightforward. So we did that, and we did get a whole collection of numbers from about 300 or 400 years out to 8,500 on one site, I think on the Carlton River, and 8,700 on another site at Rocky King, which is about 240 miles away on the other side of the island. And then nothing beyond that. We got several around 5,000 to 6,000. So what we expected turned up. Well, about this time, Australian National University instituted a new department, Institute of Aboriginal Affairs. And they sent out sociologists to interview the live ones and archaeologists to interview the dead ones. And so about this time, a young man named Chris Jones showed up. Welshman, and he had training in archaeology, and he Cambridge. He'd done diggings in Albania and Greece and Finland and around the coast of Norway and Denmark. And had some experience in these matters and some understanding. So we showed him our results. Took him to a couple places. And he looked it all over and he said, well, this is a very good experiment. It is well thought out. It is done with vigor and you got the right answer, but it's got nothing whatsoever to do with when the blacks came. So this was sort of disconcerting. I said, okay, I'm on. If it got nothing to do with when the blacks came, what does it have to do with it? He said, well, all you found out is when the sea rose to its present level. Any mids that were older are underneath the water or most likely been just washed away by wave action as the sea rose. And at these dates, around 8,000 to 9,000 or 8,500 to 9,000, are very common, and they're found on all the similar kind of places along the coast of Norway and the Shetland Islands, and Scotland, and Denmark. So the sea rose up at the same time all over the world. And in fact, as he put it, the sea rose up in two surges: one about 30,000 years ago, apparently about 150 feet, and then a smaller surge about 8,500 to 9,000 years ago. Maybe about 100 feet. So he said, you're wasting your time if you go fussing around with this anymore. And it's true, this is the first good evidence we have that the sea rose in the southern hemisphere, but that is to be expected.
No one has been disputing the sea level is different down here.
That's right.
Vines may twine differently, but the sea is at the same level.
The sea is at the same level.
But this corresponds to the retreat of the last glaciers and the melting
of
the glaciers.
That's right, melting of the Wisconsin Glacier. They probably got some other games. So he said, if you want to do the thing right, you get away from the sea, go hunt around inland, and find some caves where the blacks may have camped. You won't find any seashells, but you should find bones of native animals, charcoal, and that kind of thing. Well, I had a lot of other things to do, and I got sort of tired of it, so I didn't do anything. Anyhow, several years passed. Rather recently, maybe about a year and a half ago, a woman, also trained in Europe, came down here from the Institute of Aboriginal Affairs. She found a nice cave, I think Robbins Island, the northwest part, offshore islands, rather small island. At the time the Abos camped there, it was not an island, it was just a hill. But now it's an island since the sea rose. There was a nice cave in there, and since it's sort of a remote, protected from vandals and other people, we found some caves incidentally, and they had bones in, but they were sheep bones. So the caves we found were current. Anyhow, she had her carbon dated that came out something around 12,000 years. So Riss was right. If you get away from the seashore, find the right caves, you can get older dates. And that again isn't particularly surprising, because there are many sites in the mainland where the dates of 20,000 inferences as far back as about 25,000 are available. So man has been here in Australia far longer than he's been in North America.
And this was in the mid-60s you were doing this.
That's right.
Let me ask you a general question. You seem to, with no fear whatsoever, love to rush into a completely different field and just do it.
Well,
without having to worry about any background.
You can spend a lot of time learning, it's true, and we did waste our time. If I'd have read a lot of literature and learned about all this beforehand, I may have never done it, because I would have become convinced that what we were doing was a waste of time. So ignorance is bliss.
But you're willing to take that risk, essentially.
Sure, it was good fun. People say, what are you doing that for? And I say, look, this is a lot more fun. It's intellectual and stimulating. You get out and spend the fresh air and see new and interesting places, meet new and interesting people, and all you do is club some poor little old light ball around a golf course. I think it's disgraceful.
Okay.
You probably do it with the same bop day after day.
Let's move on to the other main area, I think, that you worked in, namely cosmic rays. How did you get involved with them?
Really, I don't know. But they had a cosmic ray. They have a cosmic ray department at the University of Tasmania, and I watched what they were doing. And I looked at some of their results, and they were doing harmonic analysis on their results, and I thought it might be possible to use the same data and handle it differently.
This was harmonic analysis on the time of arrival
of the cosmic ray particles.
Right.
In other words, they had a lot of statistics, so many cosmic rays per minute, and all the different minutes in the hour, and all the different hours in the day, and so on. Now what have we got here?
Using Geiger tubes.
Yeah, using Geiger tubes. East Coast and Airport, that's what we want. We don't want to go to Companion. I think I'll wait.
Yeah.
Now we go down here just a little ways and then make another turn. Another left turn. Come out on the road that leads south to the airport. It's not very far.
Well, you must have been thinking about cosmic rays because of your ionosphere work.
Well, perhaps.
To some extent.
Anyhow, I took this data and handled it as you would handle a random set of voltages fed into bandpass filters. And then adjusted it so that one filter had a period of, I think, 24 hours even, and another had a filter of 23 hours, 56 minutes, 23 hours, 52 minutes, and 23 hours, 48 minutes, 24 hours, and 4 minutes.
No, this is correct, straight.
It said East Coast there.
It said airport straight.
It did?
Yeah.
Is it? Okay. Well, anyhow, when the data was fed into this system, it turned out that all we got was a lot of random numbers that averaged out to nearly a straight line on four of these. But the 23-hour and 56-minute one showed a definite hump in one place and a definite minimum at the other place. I think we had 7 years of data each year. Was handled separately, and then they were all combined. And the combined one was fairly interesting. So it looked as though maybe there was a sidereal component to the cosmic rays. That is a component fixed to the sidereal universe.
Were you doing this by hand, these computations?
Pretty much. We didn't have any machinery. I hired some kids at the university to work the data over and show them what to do, that kind of thing. They didn't know what they were doing, but they were getting paid. So, this got published in the Journal of Franklin Institute about maybe 1965 or some such a date. Well, this sort of confirmed what the harmonic boys had shown, but did a little better in the sense that it was possible to get an idea of the number of particles associated with a sidereal component. It was a very small fraction, about 10 to 1% of the total count. Anyhow, it turned out to be about one particle per minute per steer radian per square meter. This is very small.
Right.
So that's the reason it took seven years to even begin to show the phenomenon. Well, I didn't do any more on that, but it did seem profitable. That is, the technique wasn't much good, really. That is, in 50 years of data, we'd have done a little better, but not a whole lot better. We'll need something much better. And thinking the whole thing over, it seemed it was an energy information contradiction here. That is, particles have tremendous energy, many millions of electron volts. And so if there were many particles, there'd be a tremendous flux of energy. So a priori, there has to be very few particles. This means you're only going to have a few events to deal with. So instead of trying some averaging technique that we tried in the past, where you have only a trivial number of events to average, we should try to learn more out of each event. In other words, get more information out of each event. This meant that each particle should be individually examined for energy and direction of arrival. Now, with the cosmic ray Geiger-Counter technique, this is not possible. What have we got here? Richmond. All right. We got to get down to 60. I've been going much more than 60. Chart.
Up here, ahead.
Well, yeah, here it is. Hobart, right turn. This must be it. Boy, I know where we are now. This isn't the way I usually come, but it's all right. In the dark, things look a little different.
So what was the best solution to this problem, do you think?
Well, it was necessary to get more information about each individual particle. And this could only be done in a bubble chamber. And I was now at Ohio State University, and I made contact with the physics department with Argonne National Laboratories, where they have a big bubble chamber. And it turned out this was very fortunately oriented, and it's about a meter in diameter, about 60 centimeters long, with the axis east and west. So this then looked out on the meridian, that is, the plane from the north to the south. And so I had a meridian transit cosmic ray telescope. And there were four cameras for stereo viewing the traces inside the bubble chamber. And there were vast quantities of photographs already available because they run this chamber day in and day out, night and day, and they fire into it stuff from their synchrotron. Well, these traces, the cosmic rays, look like meteor traces across a photographic plate taken in the night sky. But we know the curvature from measurement, we know the magnetic field that gives us the energy, and we know where the direction of arrival started before it came in. So we now know the direction of arrival of the particle and its energy, so it's not possible to divide the particles up. So they were divided up from 10 to the 9th, 10 to the 10th electron volts. That's a billion to 10 billion. 10 to 10 to 10 to the 11th, and 10 to the 11th up. And I don't remember exactly how many particles we had, but altogether we had several hundred particles. So then we analyzed the particles in the first group. Well, I think we divided them up into smaller groups than that, I think from 1 to 3 and 3 to 10, 10 to 30, and so on. Anyhow, we divided them up, and for the lower energy groups, we couldn't find there was any difference with galactic latitude or galactic longitude. So, for all intents and purposes, the particles were coming in uniformly all over the sky. However, when we got up to the 10 to the 11th electron volts, I think we only had 68 particles some such small number, less than 100. And it was found that it was a significant, the larger fraction of it came from the region plus or minus 30 degrees of galactic latitude than from above that. So this suggested that there was a slight clustering toward the plane of the galaxy of particles having energy of 10 to the 11 electron volts or greater. And this got published in the proceedings of the Journal of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific about 1970.
Do you have any more plans to follow that up?
It'd be nice, but I got so many other things to do. I'd like to encourage somebody else to do it. And actually, according to the magazines I read, they're going to shut this alternating gradient synchrotron down. But we don't need that thing anyhow to run this, do this experiment. All we need is the bubble chamber. So it may be we can get organized to just run the bubble chamber alone and analyze the data. But it would be nice to do it on a much larger scale, instead of having only less than 100 particles above 10 to the 11th, and say 1,000 particles.
Well, there must be much more data that exists. That's all that you had time to analyze.
That's right. There is much more data than we could get it, I presume.
And there was one other aspect of it which you told me about, namely, after you saw the way that these two brothers at the University of Tasmania, what is their name?
Fentons, A.G. Yes. and K.B.
They were using 1940s technology, and
really,
you determined that it could be better done.
Well,
can you briefly describe what you did?
This data I analyzed was taken by Bob Jacklin, old railway tunnel over by Cambridge. But the tubes in it were glass tubes that is about a meter long and maybe a couple of inches in diameter, 5 centimeters, say. And they had an internal plating on the tube and tungsten wire down the center. This is a design that was hit upon by people long in the 1940s. Have a very large background count, that is, the tubes are continually being activated. I inquired about that, and I was told that this was due to the radioactive potassium 40 in the glass. Well, this seemed unfortunate. Should be able to design Geiger tubes that didn't have such a large internal noise. There's all this internal discharges. Like the noise in the radio signal. So we need to improve the signal to noise ratio by a lot, not 2 or 10, but 100 to 1. This might have to cut down the internal noise caused by the tube itself. So I had some copper Geiger tubes made in Japan, different pressures. I tried them out. And copper should be pretty inert. No radioactive isotopes, so the tube should be of low background count. But it didn't turn out to be that simple, because wherever I had these tubes, they still produced a fairly high count number. Not as high as the glass tube, pretty high, maybe half what the glass tube produced. So then there was a big vat installed for cooking things, maybe about 6 feet high, 3 feet in diameter, big steel lid. And so I hung one of the Geiger tubes in there to see what would happen. And the count dropped, not much, maybe 3 or 4%, something like that, compared to when the tube was outside this vat. And then I filled the vat full of water, and it dropped about another 5 or 6%. So the effect of the water was equal to or more than the half inch of steel. Anyhow,